Welcome to the debate at Newsweek. I'm Andrew Tallman. Today, we're joined by Mark Davis, syndicated talk show host on 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth and a columnist for the Dallas Morning News and Town Hall. As a guy who hasn't written in a while, I'm always jealous of you people who still get to write for a living. And Rakeem Brooks, president of the Alliance for Justice Action Campaign, a progressive judicial advocacy group. Gentlemen, welcome to the debate.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us again.
Absolutely. So let's start with the hard stuff first. Big conversations we're having just after the 50th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. Of course, the Dobbs ruling essentially jettisoned that the first time in 50 years that hasn't been the law of the land. And the particular issue that a lot of people are talking about right now are changes in the availability of the abortion pill. And I don't normally do this, but I'm going to just give a little bit of fact background here, because I think for people who might not be familiar, it might be useful. The morning after pill or plan B or emergency contraception, that's the one that if you have unprotected sex or a sexual assault, you take it within a couple of days and that prevents ovulation so you cannot become pregnant. That's not the one that people are talking about right now. The abortion pill is the two-stage mifepristone and misoprostol that does two things. It first stops development of the fetus, and then you take the second pill, and it causes a cramping of the uterus that essentially spontaneously ejects whatever was in there up to 10 weeks after your previous period. That's the one that is particularly under discussion right now, because the FDA recently made it available for pharmacies to dispense. Previously, the doctor, you still have to have a prescription, but then there were these sort of special clinics that would dispense it. With the ability to dispense from a pharmacy, you've got a lot of controversy about whether that's appropriate. And of course, in states, now post-Dobbs, like Alabama, where it's illegal to have abortion at any period, or Florida up to 15 weeks, or you know, in South Dakota, you now have the question of whether this is going to be allowed, whether pharmacies are violating the state law against abortion or other laws about, for example, in Alabama, chemicals that harm a fetus are a separate category historically. All right, so that's the background. That's the just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. The most recent news is that Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, says, we're not going to let pharmacies dispense this in our state because it's a violation of our state law. Rakeem, let's start with you. Your thoughts on this announcement slash kind of decision, where we're at in the culture today?
Yeah, it seems sort of like showboating. It reminds me of Trump's wall, right, to prevent illegal immigration, when most illegal immigration is caused by people flying in, actually, and overstaying their visas. The same thing is going to result here. The governor might very well ban pharmacies from distributing the abortion medications, but ultimately people will acquire it by doing telehealth, using telehealth and having it mailed to them. And so there's going to be a set of other controversies soon to come, I think. But for right now, I mean, the main thing to remember is that states are interfering with a pregnant person's right to choose, right? That remains the current controversy, and it's presently live at the state level. And so many Republican governors, I think, as sort of next steps, because they're running out of things to do now that they actually have the right to prevent people from having abortions, are going to point out ever more increasingly draconian ways of preventing people from getting abortions. And then we'll watch things get mailed in and figure out what they have to do then.
So just a question, because I'm kind of curious your perspective on this. I know as somebody who believes in the right of access to abortion, obviously you're very frustrated about the Dobbs decision. Do you think that given the current law that states are uniquely in the wrong because they're also enforcing this prohibition against abortion against chemical or pharmaceutical abortion? Is there something distinct about that? Or are you just, I think states ought to allow it and therefore also they ought to allow this?
What's the more general principle? States ought to allow it, and therefore they ought to allow this. But okay, also just pointing out the practicality of it, which is the only thing you're doing is harming your local pharmacy's sales. Now, I assume, given their position and the right to life, that's well worth it. But as I said, most of the people who are going to go to a pharmacy and be able to acquire the drug are going to be able to get it through telehealth and through the U.S. mail. And interstate commerce should be a final barrier to preventing the states from blocking it. But we'll see.
Mark Davis, your thoughts?
In going through Rakeem's answer, I think he's completely right. In the very beginning, in terms of ways to massage what a given state's laws might be. If indeed Governor Noem or any other Republican governor says, look, in our state, abortion is illegal. So that means abortion drugs are illegal. So that means pharmacies cannot dispense them in our state. That is 100% within a state's purview to have that law. Then once we go farther afield, because I guess in the days of the months following the Dobbs ruling and following the death of Roe v. Wade, we obviously feel very differently about that. I celebrated it enormously, not because I am pro-life, because I acknowledge a state like California or New York, their right to be as ghoulishly pro-choice as they wish. It's not my business. As such, there would be many states that are pro-life, which Rakim doesn't like. I understand that, but that's what the founders intended, is a tapestry of state-by-state experiments. There is no right to abortion in the Constitution. The Supreme Court properly found that. So what we have is states able to do what they wish. Some will be really permissive and some will not.
You know, it's particularly interesting. Like the case of Alabama is fascinating because their law prohibiting abortion specifically exempted punishing the woman particularly. But there's another law, I think it's called the Protection Against Chemical Harm Act or something like that, that was originally passed to protect children against their mothers using drugs and meth lab fumes and things like this. That's been used historically against women who take drugs and harm the fetus. It is now being used, or at least considered to be used, against the women who consume the abortion pill. So the applications here, even though the law itself prohibiting abortion would not touch the woman, only the dispenser or the provider, they're starting to look at that side of it and actually applying this other law in that direction. So Rakim, you said you think this is kind of grandstanding, or maybe that's too uncharitable of a word, but do you see the ideological follow through here from people who are, you know, pro-life or anti-abortion? They view abortion under any method is wrong, and therefore this is just the next step. We're following through on that commitment. We eliminate surgical abortion, therefore we're going to eliminate chemical or pharmaceutical abortion. Do you at least see that slice of it?
No, of course, I see the logical consistency of it. The reason I call it grandstanding is because it's almost like when President Trump during the campaign, so when he was candidate Trump, said the quiet part out loud, which is, well, we intend to prosecute anybody who has an abortion. And suddenly the pro-life movement was like, wait a minute, that is not the line we have taken for most of our existence. The same thing is operating here. So by targeting pharmacists, it's almost like targeting the doctors, which has been a longstanding practice of the pro-life movement. But what we're really getting to, and the ghoulish thing, as Mark sort of suggested, is that where it comes, the rubber hits the road, is imagine that people do in fact order these drugs and do in fact self-medicate to have abortions. And now you have police and constables in your home. I say constables just because I'm thinking about the Third Amendment. I think the founders did not intend for government to be in our intimate decisions in exactly this way. So suddenly you're going to have people knocking at the door saying, we believe you received a package through the U.S. mail, and we believe that it may contain abortion-inducing drugs. Have you used them? That is the truly mortifying experiment that we're about to embark upon in the United States. And I think that the pro-life movement and Republicans are not willing to admit that they may in fact go that far and produce the exact kind of Handmaid's Tale scenarios that people are so frightened by. Now, that seems like it's in the extreme, but just imagine that a woman is in her home and wants to terminate her pregnancy. The government will in fact come in and say, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to swallow this pill that otherwise would be between you and your doctor making a medical decision.
Those of us in the pro-life world, and he's right on a couple of levels. Number one, going after women has never been good optics. It's never been part of it. And I think when Trump was riffing about that, I can make a long list of things Trump said that didn't exactly adhere specifically and strictly and stridently to what policy wound up being. But he's right that if using my prior example, if in a state abortion is illegal, what does that mean? Does it mean doctors can't perform it? Absolutely. Does it mean pharmacies can't dispense the abortion drugs? That seems to follow. Does it mean that a woman in Pierre, Bismarck, North Dakota, I get my Dakotas mixed up, that a woman receiving the package through telehealth or through some out of state dispensary, that she can't take it in her own home? That's a whole new stretch of law. I will suggest that those of us who are interested in protecting the unborn do not find that mortifying. We find it tricky because that will be an area where some people will be on board and some will not. Can I ask everybody, in view of the definitions that Andrew put out, in view of the existence of Plan B, which is not an abortion pill, which I'm not aware of a governor, my own governor, Greg Abbott here in Texas, says, hey, problem solved. If there's the horrible examples, which are mortifying, rape, incest, et cetera, Plan B, the hormonal preventer of pregnancy, so that you don't in fact have an abortion, isn't that the solution that solves the whole problem?
Well, I think one of the challenges, just as a sort of fact matter, maybe, is the morning after pill or Plan B is only effective if you haven't ovulated, right? So if the woman has ovulated already, then Plan B will not prevent her from having the egg fertilized and conceiving. So there's kind of that, it doesn't catch all the cases, so to speak, is one of the challenges, I think people would say. One of the other things, just for clarity's sake, because I think it might help the people understand, like I apparently am the, I'm a very pro-life. Okay. So I think that it's, you know, it's wrong and it ought to be illegal. I don't particularly distinguish the ethics of the surgical versus the pharmaceutical. I think they all kind of rise or fall together. But I am curious about a tension that has always been present in the pro-life movement. And Mark, you alluded to it, is that we want to say that it's wrong to do this thing. And we want to then say, but it's only wrong for the one part of the transaction to do the thing. Whereas for, you know, the doctor is in the wrong, but the woman, we're not going to prosecute. That's always seemed weird to me, because if you genuinely believe that it's a human being, then participating in the ending of that being's life, it doesn't, how can that be okay just because you're the recipient of the procedure? I've always found that attention within my own movement. And I think Mark is probably right that for optics sake, because nobody wants to be viewed as the one that prosecutes women. Rakim, when you look at that part of this problem, I mean, does it look hypocritical to you? Does it look like we're not willing to embrace the consequences of our own viewpoints?
Yes. Absolutely. I don't mean to laugh about it because it's definitely serious.
No, it's very serious. But, yeah, let's be fair, right?
I've always thought that. I used to say to pro-life friends of mine, well, if you view yourselves as the modern abolitionists, you know, wear your John Browns. And of course, the point about John Brown is not actually to encourage violence. It's really to make the point that there's a certain kind of consistency that leads you to certain positions. I really use that question to figure out who's crazy in the room. But you realize that there are several other things at play in making a decision about weighing the right to life versus freedom to choose question. My view is continued to be, this is the province of one individual making a choice about his or her body, pregnant person, usually a woman. So making a choice about their body and the government not interfering. My beliefs with regard to what that person should do with their body is the same as euthanasia and other issues that I care deeply about, which is if you choose to end your life, it's your turn to choose to end your life. The government should not be involved in that decision. And I think one of the differences between Mark and I, and perhaps Andrew, you and I, is that it doesn't matter to me whether it's the federal government or the state government. I don't know how the state government gained the ability to override my inalienable rights if the federal government didn't have the right to override my inalienable rights. So I just think we don't ask hard enough questions in that respect. But yes, in terms of the hypocrisy, I think people, maybe I'm being unfair. People are living as we do. No, I think so. I mean,
well, I would say hypocrisy is like a deliberate lie. I would say
I mean by being fair is that we live in a liberal society that is broadly tolerant in all sorts of degrees of any number of things, right? The fact that you believe something and you're willing to create a law that prohibits it or enables it in certain ways doesn't mean you allow for it in all circumstances. So I presume that the pro-life movement feels similarly in this regard, that they want to save as many unborn children as they can, even if they could not save all of them by interfering with the doctor and the pharmacist, but not with the woman directly. But that being said, you would think that the logical conclusion would be that you would interfere with every person who was attempting.
And the heat that Rakim applies here is 100% appropriate. And Andrew, the point that you made is one that the pro-life movement absolutely must address. We are the ones who say, we pro-lifers are the ones who say that a human life is a human life, and that a two-year-old walking through this room is not so very distinguishable from a baby in the womb. we always say it's just geography. A baby that's out walking around is to be protected, but one that's in the womb is just a tumor, is just an appendage. That's crazy. That absolutely invites precisely the kind of tough reckoning for pro-lifers that I'm glad to invite. And that is that just as we would prosecute a mother who kills a two-year-old, the mother who terminates a pregnancy at 3-4 months, tell me how different that is. I think the call for consistency is cannot be shirked.
Yeah, and I take Rakim's point very seriously. Both the one you were just mentioning, Mark, about how if we're going to be emphatic that this is a full-fledged, full rights, embodied, protected by law human being at the moment of conception, then the question of aiding and abetting at the very least, you know, would be appropriate. But then what Rakim says is, again, if you take that analogy seriously, if you say that the 3-month fetus is absolutely equal in every way to the 1-year-old or the 2-year-old, then why do you make the decision to not intervene aggressively in every way possible to stop that the way you would if you knew your neighbor was horribly harming their child?
The answer to that is obvious, because it is political. It's a political disaster waiting to happen. You wait to see those pro-life politicians. I mean, we can sit here and sling stuff around on the Newsweek debate, and properly so. But imagine being the politician out on the stump saying, ladies, we're coming after you. How's that going to go over?
Right. And I would just add to that. I mean, part of the reason the ladies were coming after you line would be so terrible is because we who believe that folks should have a right to an abortion ultimately believe that this is about control. And so they would be saying the quiet part out loud, which is we intend to stop you from doing with your body what you believe that you should be able to do with your body. As I've said before on the debate, this is a deeply personal question that to me goes to the heart of what liberalism is about. I mean, this is about usually the people who are pro-life have a faith commitment of some sort that they are attempting to impose on someone else who does not share that faith commitment. I mean, that to me is the fundamental divide. And liberalism, as we experience it in the United States, was meant to deal with interreligious conflict first and foremost. And so the idea that we would use the state to impose one person's moral and religious beliefs on someone else in this particular context, which again is about an individual. I take Mark's point that it's just about geography. I hadn't heard that one. That sounds bizarre to me, but I understand the rhetoric that's used in that space. This is a central liberal concern. And I think it's one of the reasons that people are so animated about Roe, not just in the context of abortion, but thinking about the panoply of rights that sit in this space that have been protected by substantive due process that now seem undermined by the Dobbs decision.
And just because of, you know, you kind of brought up the question, Rakim, is sometimes pro-lifers articulated as, you know, size. The difference between, say, a born infant and a fetus would be size, level of development, environment or location, and then dependency. And none of those things, they would say, distinguishes between life and non-life in a legal or ethical sense. That's why trying to draw the line between what is and is not a human being. Just one final thought before we transition. We haven't really dug deep on the question, and it may be for another time, but the taking of the pill in the privacy of your own home, of course, the government does regulate things like that, cocaine, fentanyl, other things, whether those laws are appropriate or not. We do regulate what you put inside your body to a fair degree, although typically it's not because you're harming allegedly someone else by taking it, but harming yourself. We're going to be back on the debate. We'll talk a little bit about lotteries and whether they're predatory on the poor. I'm Andrew Tallman.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back on the debate talking with Mark Davis and Rakim Brooks, and an interesting article recently talking about whether the lottery, which we're all following in some sense, it's rolling over and not winning, and it's untold millions and billions of dollars or whatever. And Les Bernal, the national director of Stop Predatory Gambling, says essentially the lottery isn't just a tax on people who can't do math well. It's a tax on poor people who can't do math well and don't really have the money to waste on it. We are harming them by advertising to them and generating state revenue on their backs and selling them lottery tickets at check cashing enterprises because they don't do banking. What do you guys think? Is the lottery problematic for the way that it affects poor people? Let's start with you, Mark.
I'm fairly libertarian about gambling. If someone wants to do it, it strikes me as something they have a right to do in terms of like going to Vegas or going to the track in states that have tracks and have casinos, et cetera, et cetera. I hate lotteries. It makes my teeth itch to see government begging people to gamble. Not all of these big ticket lotteries are run by government. I'm also a big believer that private industry, the private sector, can do whatever it wishes to do. So it makes it a kind of a complicated answer. I'm in the mood to allow private entities to have massive lottery payouts. I never want government to, because I don't ever want government begging people to gamble or deceiving them into thinking the money goes to roads or the money goes to education, which it almost never does. It absolutely breaks my heart to see a line of 100 people at a convenience store when a certain amount gets to be a certain several billion dollars. Those people like would not be there if it was one, you know, it was like 30 million. It's like, I spit on your 30 million, but 900 million, I'm there. Like they have any additional chance of winning. And I know full well that a lot of those people, pardon me, scarcely have a pot to pee in. And it just absolutely breaks my heart. But I try to run my life not making decisions for other people, just hoping that they make smarter decisions than almost any lottery ticket is.
Rakim?
Mark and I are in somewhat of a similar place. I mean, I hate government paternalism as much as he does. I used to laugh. My dad, when I was growing up, I grew up sort of working class. We sometimes walk past the store and he said, son, I got a dollar and a dream, right? He'd go ahead and buy himself a lottery ticket. I don't think there's anything wrong with it in that perspective, which is the reasonable use of lotteries and gambling to have a good time. However, to Mark's more general point, I'd even go further. The state should not be involved in a predatory behavior that builds addiction among certain communities, particularly its most vulnerable communities. I can't think of a scenario in which we might say the state, of course, has the right to raise revenue, but I can't think of a scenario in which we would say it has the right to perpetuate addiction among a group of people who
and benefit from it, not just perpetuate it, but depend upon it.
Right, depend upon it and continue to grow it. So it's a bizarre thing that we've allowed for. Now, of course, states normally skim off the top of things that they're perpetuating. So they allow for the sale of cigarettes and they tax it. They allow for the sale of alcohol and they tax it. And it eventually it'll be marijuana and any number of other recreational drugs that people engage in that may have deleterious effects for their health. But at this level, as the article sort of points out, there's virtually no benefit. I mean, maybe like the short-lived high that you get from buying a ticket and just imagining what it might be like to go on that forever vacation where you never return to your job. But otherwise, there's entirely no benefit. And so I do think it's a predatory practice. I do think it should be regulated and folks should be thinking about it much more intensely. But I don't think the level at which we intervene is actually the individual. What the individual is trying to do is, and I wanted somebody to run these numbers. I mean, if I'm a Black man growing up as I did in East Harlem with a high school education or less, what do I have a better chance of making it out of there by purchasing a lottery ticket or by doing some set of activities that the government says will be good for me in order to become a middle-class citizen? I have never run the numbers, but I assume that the odds are equally stark. And so this person may just be taking a chance and saying, look, this dollar that I spend today on this, and then I go back to work the next day, that seems to me perfectly balanced from that perspective.
So I share both of your concerns with the paternalism, right? I hate the government deciding for people what they can and can't consume with their own money. But I look at this and I think the exact same thoughts. I think the lottery advertises specifically to the most vulnerable. It targets its advertising based on the level of affluence of the people that are watching the TV or listening to the radio or attending the place. And there's something just unbelievably vulgar about a person who is so economically low on the scale that they don't even have a bank account. So they go to the check cashing corner store and then they turn around and put $50 into a machine to get a single scratch off ticket. It seems insane to me. And especially given how, if you can save a little over time, many years, you know, that's one of the great keys to wealth building, right? Instead of putting it into this hopeless endeavor that you're not going to benefit from, if people could simply save. But the question is that what they would do? I mean, it's optimistic to say they would be saving, but, you know, whether it's the numbers or, you know, the bingo parlor or whatever other form of gambling, people want to do this behavior, right? Would it solve anything if you took this avenue away, Mark?
The only thing that it would solve is because Rakeem properly mentioned the notion of cigarette taxes and stuff like that, because those are the so-called sin taxes. But the government doesn't beg you to smoke. The government doesn't say, hey, go get a carton of Luckies because you can help pay off the state's transportation debt. In the case of gambling, the state absolutely begs you to do this, floating these dreams in front of these people and not to
continue. And portraying it like it's civic virtue, right? You're helping
exactly education. Right. It's like, you know, you're doing it. It's like, I love this where it's like voluntary taxation. Right. But to go back to that visual, and I don't want to be stereotypical or cliche about the visual, because they could be in any neighborhood, they could be of any race. What they absolutely share is, let's say, economic distress. But just about all those people in that line at that convenience store to get that lottery ticket probably have beer in the fridge, or probably smoking a cigarette in line, and probably have a cell phone in their pocket.
Rakeem?
Yeah, I was going to add, I mean, you were asked the right question, Andrew. When I first knew we'd be talking about this topic, what immediately came to mind is, again, this is just an escape for an otherwise poor person, typically, right? It's not something that would be resolved if we got rid of the lottery, because that $1 saved, that $50, that $100 is likely to go not into a savings account, but towards some expense that they have trying to make their way through the world on minimum wage. And so I initially had this moment of when I was thinking about the paternalism of saying, like, why are we actually focused on the conditions that put this person in a place where that $50 is of such great consequence to their life that we're focused on it, that $10 is of such great consequence that we're focused on it. I remember when I always tell folks this, when I was growing up, a $5 milkshake, that's all I wanted. It's all I wanted in the world. I didn't have $5, right? That's how much it meant to me. Now I have it, and it's not of concern, but I never forget that concern and wonder why it is that we're not addressing the root causes of that deprivation, as opposed to how someone spends what little money they have afterwards, assuming that somehow thrift and ingenuity is going to be the way out of a minimum wage job. Statistically, it's just as unlikely as winning the lottery.
I often wonder about the lottery if, you know, I take a very negative view. I'm much like Mark. I find it a disgusting thing. But I also, you know, pay attention to the way people talk about it. And I think maybe there's a rational transaction here. You know, somebody has a little bit of crazy hope. They get to buy a dream for a moment. It costs them a couple of bucks. And maybe that lifts their spirits and makes them feel good. I mean, we do stuff like that in every area of our lives to make ourselves feel better. How dare I take that opportunity, as senseless and irrational as it is, away from somebody who otherwise believes, you know, this is fine. And I guess the distinction I kind of feel like drawing is between the person who just buys a ticket once a week or periodically and the person who's plopping down $100 or $200, you know, who's doing this an awful lot. And I wish there were a way to stop that from happening, to protect the person from themselves, without taking away the, you know, mild expense that costs you no more than a soda or a French fries to get that little level of hope. Is there any way to really effectively draw that distinction with the law, Mark?
The short answer is no. It is what it is. And the wall we've run up against, that you've properly established, that Rakeem has talked about skillfully, it is what it is. Because we have liberty. If you have a lottery, everybody is free to use it as they wish. And in Rakeem's example of, you know, a dollar or two, even somebody who's really of meager means can drop a dollar or two and nobody's going to wag a finger, because, hey, you never know what might happen. But sadly, that's not what some people are doing. Some people are putting rent money, you know, college fund money, rent, food money into the lottery on this 99.99999% false hope that they're going to win. But the other thing I've wished is, I see some of these, pardon the term here, obscenely large payouts. The only reason I feel that way is, let's say you have a $1 billion payout, which some of them get to that. which is going to drag
for most people is an unfathomable amount of money. It absolutely is. Nobody can.
I wish there were a way instead of having one person saddled with, and it does tend to ruin people's lives when they win this money. Instead, take 1,000 people and change their lives to a somewhat lesser degree. But I don't know mathematically how to do that. And since it's probably impossible, here's the baby, here's the bathwater. Got to figure out whether to keep them both or throw them both out.
And Rakeem, I love your point about, you know, can we not figure out a way to solve the kind of the structure around the problem so that people can basically be safe to engage in a little bit of frivolous wastefulness because we've, you know, made their lives better off. And also to where the hope of winning a lottery isn't the best thing they've got going in their lives. That's an awful situation to imagine for anybody. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about everybody's favorite neo-monopoly, Ticketmaster, here on The Debate.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back on The Debate at Newsweek, and I will confess to start, I haven't gone to a big ticket concert in a long time. And I mean, the last for me was like Rolling Stones, Steel Wheels. Okay. So it's been a minute since I've been to a big ticket concert. So I don't feel like I know the nuances of waiting online and running four computers to try to get in on time or whatever people do. Nevertheless, I listened to Senator Blumenthal excoriate the operators of Ticketmaster and Live Nation this week and how they are operating essentially a neo-monopoly. They have so much control, so much power, and that when an absolute debacle like the Taylor Swift ticket purchasing thing happens, they can basically wave it off and say, oh, well, next, because who's going to stop them? So again, coming from a place of dramatic ignorance on my own part, Rakeem, your thoughts about Ticketmaster, Live Nation, solving the problem. If you have any grand ideas, I'm curious. Go ahead.
Sure. The thing I love about The Debate is you make me research things that I don't actually care about. And so I had to go and educate myself about this. And I have to say, I concluded at the end of it that I still don't care about it. If Democrats and Republicans are agreed about this, I realized there must be something wrong. So I said, okay, we've got the Ticketmaster problem, which is allegedly a monopoly and probably so based on everything that I've read and really terrible for folks. But then I just went and looked around and I found this wonderful article from The Economist that says Apple controls 62% of the market share in America. American Express, MasterCard, and Visa control 95% of the credit card market. Google controls 60% of the browser market, 78% of the telecoms market controlled by three groups, and four airlines control 70% of the journeys within America. And we're focused on Ticketmaster. That means they have bad lobbyists. That's ultimately what's happening. We have other issues to be concerned about in terms of monopolistic behavior in a society that genuinely affect how people live their lives. I want to see Taylor Swift as much as the next person. Not really, but I'm just going to be in the company of folks, right? I understand the impulse. But the fact that they were able to make so much out of this is just another example of American theater and distraction. There are many other issues that we should be concerned about in the monopolistic behaviors of our major companies.
Taylor Swift disclaimers, I feel like we all ought to offer one aside. Mark Davis, your thoughts about this?
There is nothing more cringe-inducing than watching senators my age drop Taylor Swift lyrics into their questioning of some of these executives.
Amy Klobuchar is apparently quite adept at it.
Oh, sure she is. And anyway, the reason this was, and I share what we might call Rakeem's informed disinterest, except with the following asterisk. on the show that I host, where this was all breaking at that exact moment, I heard from a ton of people who were generationally similar to me. And the reason they were all fired up about it is because they had a house full of 14-year-olds who wanted to go. And for them, their children's dreams were shattered by this massive snafu. The examples that Rakim gave were just golden. Airlines and computers and search engines. And I don't know if we'll see this the same way. To me, that's just called the marketplace. I mean, if you want to make a better search engine, do it. If you want to make a better computer company, do it. If you want to make a better airline, do it.
Mark's side job is a lobbyist for Google, by the way. I didn't think I told him about that. So go ahead, Mark.
There should not be anything structurally that inherently prevents people from trying to carve out their part of the marketplace. And it's hard to do. If you've got a street corner that has a Target and a Walmart, you probably don't want to put a big box store on that street corner because they're already there. This was a horrible thing that happened. It is not earth shattering. It's not an asteroid headed toward the planet, but listen, neither is the Amazon delivery that I'm going to get later on today. But if something messes up with that, it's a big deal to me. So the only thing I would do to tie a bow around the whole Ticketmaster thing is it's the harsh lesson that the marketplace which is the altar where I metaphorically worship, when you do have huge part of market share, what are you going to do? Boycott Ticketmaster? There ought to be access for other ticket acquisition technologies to be able to shoulder this burden and make those tickets available. Because what happened to those kids, and many of them were kids, tickets being bought by parents notwithstanding, they got screwed because of the avarice and the arrogance of Live Nation and Ticketmaster.
You know, one thought, and I wouldn't normally advocate for the Wanda Sykes solution, but she's hosting this week for The Daily Show, and she made a joke about this that I think is not all that much of a joke. She said, "I remember the good old days when you had to go camp out, wait in line, risk frostbite, and then hopefully their operators were fast enough to be able to get you a ticket." There's something kind of magically beautiful about cost in getting these tickets. And the story you tell isn't just about the concert you attended, but about the lengths you went to in order to actually acquire the ticket. I know it's not going to happen, but Rakim, can we at least agree that there's something weirdly elegant about making the technology more primitive and forcing people to go invest their bodies in waiting for the Taylor Swift ticket?
I'm not taking a bait on that one. I love it because I love Wanda Sykes, but I'm not taking a bait. I remember standing outside. For me, when I was a kid, it was professional wrestling. Oh God, the person I was. But I used to love it. And to stand outside waiting for tickets at Madison Square Garden and getting screwed by scalpers and so forth, I'm so glad to be away from that era. One thing I was going to say that did interest me about this story is that the Ticketmaster Live Nation merger was approved in 2010 under the Obama administration, which then, as a avowed liberal, made me think, what the heck is going on? Like, we need to do an investigation, again, to my bigger picture point, of the Department of Justice and the Antitrust Division. I mean, this was obvious if you looked at the two pieces that were combining in the vertical integration, that this was going to eventually create all sorts of trouble. And people protested it at the time. And there were small concessions made here and there, which suggests to me maybe they had better lobbyists then than they do now.
Mark, a return to the good old days of yore when the real fan and a ticket was the guy who'd get paid to stand in line?
I'm older than all of you, Wanda included. And so I share that memory in the 70s. And I'm growing up in the suburbs of D.C., whether it was to go see Led Zeppelin or Earth, Wind & Fire or, the Doobie Brothers or Chicago or whatever. And you also ran into real human beings. You met actual human beings when you were trying just to be in line to shell out that $12.50 to get a good seat. And even then, if you were first in line,
$12.50 dates you way more than Earth, Wind, and Fire, man. Go on.
Here you go. even if you were first in line, you still got tickets halfway back at the cavernous Capitol Center in Largo, Maryland, because the man had already come in and had scarfed up 5,000 of the best seats for promoters, record companies, radio stations, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the golden rule. Those with the gold make the rules.
And in the old days, the fury and frustration died out over late night conversations with your friends instead of getting enough traction on Instagram and TikTok to get it all the way to a Senate hearing. So
it was a better America.
All the things that change. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, a light subject, the doomsday clock on The Debate.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
We're back on The Debate. We've got the doomsday clock, which has been in effect for decades now. I think it was 7 minutes to midnight at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was just updated yesterday or this week to 90 seconds from Armageddon. It had been 100 seconds from Armageddon. And the idea is this is the first time they've updated the clock since the invasion of Ukraine with Russia and all the threats about nuclear weapons and threats to Chernobyl or Zabarinska, whatever. The question I have for you guys is the clock relevant? Does the clock affect you? Does it make you think differently about your life, the world, where we stand? Or, and I'll go ahead and advocate in advance, is this a silly thing that it's just always almost midnight? What difference does 10 seconds make? Rakim?
It doesn't matter. No, I don't govern my life by the 90 seconds to midnight because I have no concept of what that even means, right? Like, it doesn't tell me actually how far. Maybe if they said 1 second to midnight, it feels so instant that I'd say, okay, maybe I should align my affairs, but everything's going to be gone. So what would be the point? But the thing I want to say about this generally is when I learned about this and read a few articles about it, it reminded me of, you all may not even know this person, is a great Black comedian, Adele Givens. And she has a great line where she says, when she was growing up, her grandmother used to always say, you know, we living in our last days. And she would say, you know, you don't say that to a five-year-old. She'd go around with her bike saying, Grandma, can I ride my bike one more time? She's like, finally, I got old enough and my grandmother said the same thing. We living in our last days. And I had to grab her around the neck and say, Grandma, when you were dating Grandpa, were y'all living in your last days? I mean, I'm so tired of a certain generation telling me that we're like near the end. Can I get to, you know, let me get to 70 and then I can join the chorus at some point.
Mark, does the doomsday clock affect your daily life, set the tone at your dinner table, have any impact on what you do?
It does not, but hopefully in the closing moments, let me invite back in something that might be more systemic to what the debate is all about. If we agree, well, first of all, if we agree, A, that it is a good idea to pay attention to a dangerous world and how actually dangerous it is and how to mitigate those dangers, all good there, that what becomes silly and what becomes ridiculous is this actual device of the clock. It is absurd. As you properly said, it was 7 minutes to midnight during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and now it's five times worse. By definition, that's crazy. But let me just throw a little chum in the water here for everybody. You ready? Usually, it has just been about how close we are to nuclear annihilation. Lately, I have noticed that for two things, and I'll do these in ascending order of absurdity. Number one, COVID, which of course has been an ordeal for everybody, but the notion that involves doomsday clock consideration is absurd. And now here we go, everybody. Stand by, strap in, keep your hands inside the vehicle. Climate change. God help us. Now we can have that debate, and maybe we're about to, as to whether man is actually about to destroy the planet. But a nuclear detonation will absolutely kill people and fry parts of the planet. My SUV, I don't know so much.
You know, I try to always imagine what's life like for the person who doesn't see things my way And so I'm always trying to think, like in this case, okay, the person who really cares about the doomsday clock, I try to imagine that on their wall in some position of prominence in the study, maybe, or over the television where the children watch their cartoons, that they've got some, you know, synced in version of the doomsday clock to remind them at a sober moment when they were eating their chicken wings and having a fine time watching football. Oh, 90 seconds. Like, is there really a person where that's life for them? I can't wrap my brain around it. So it seems very much like this pedantic exercise. Like Rakim said, what am I supposed to do with 10 seconds? What level of extra anxiety or motivation is that supposed to provide to me? I don't see it. All right, we're gonna end. Go ahead.
I was just going to add one quick thing, which is I want to know what it would take for the clock to go backwards. Has it gone backwards?
It does. Yeah. It does wiggle backwards.
What a great question. When did it? What happened?
Yeah, so what happened?
I knew this and I have forgotten it, but it has, in fact, moved away from midnight at times. Yes, it has.
Okay, yeah, because, you know, maybe that would be suggested.
Doesn't make the news as much.
I'd be curious if I would do the things that it now takes to move it backwards.
Exactly right, because either to move the clock back is either an objectively good thing or just something that the keepers of the clock want to have happen, and I don't know if I'm on board for that agenda.
Well, I think what happens is when, you know, you're driving out to dinner at a really nice restaurant and all of a sudden the news comes on and says, hey, we just moved the clock back 15 seconds. You're like, it's Chili's because we can't afford to splurge.
Right.
Last question for you. A fairly serious topic, honestly, and I hate to end on something serious, but it is one that's very timely right now because we're having this conversation about responsibility on the set of the Rust movie. Alec Baldwin taking a gun that was declared cold, would only have blanks, and of course we all know the story, winds up having a real bullet in it, and he winds up shooting and killing Halyna Hutchins on the set. He's being charged, okay, because the law of the state actually allows him to be charged for negligent manslaughter, I think is involuntary manslaughter is the charge. This is just, I'm just curious about quick reactions here. In this particular environment, Rakim, did he realistically have an obligation to inspect the bullet in the gun to be sure that the bullet was a blank and not a real gun? Is that a reasonable thing to expect him to have done? And if he didn't, therefore, he's negligent in some sense. What do you think?
Yeah, the lawyer in me tells me don't prejudge without understanding.
Yeah, fair enough.
I will assume, which I normally don't, that the prosecutors in this case really thought about this long and hard and tried to figure out whether or not the standard could be met before they would take it before a jury. It feels, as an outsider, just having read the things or seen the things that you both probably have, that this just seems unlikely. So it leads me to believe there are some set of facts that haven't been shared with us that led the prosecutors to believe that they should move forward. It couldn't have just been, you know, that he had some duty to inspect, but maybe he ought not to have been handling the gun in the way that he did, that there are other set requirements about how you engage in a scene like that for extra added protection. I don't know, but I just believe that there's more there and that it'll come out once the trial begins, assuming they get to that point.
So a deference to the prosecutorial judgment and the totality of circumstances that you may not be aware of. Fair, Mark?
I hope that's true, because I would like to believe that. My faith in such things is diminished lately, that prosecutors absolutely have their ducks in a row. I've seen far too many malicious or political or grandstanding type prosecutions. I don't know that this is one. I don't know at all. And Rakim properly says there's a lot that we should know what we don't know. And also everybody filters it through this. This is a qualifier I shouldn't have to make, but I will, because everybody calling my show did. Alec Baldwin politically makes my teeth itch. That should have absolutely nothing to do with anyone's opinion of this. And so mine is this, as both an actor or even as the guy whose production company had control over the set, I find it a really long bridge to walk across to make this his fault. You're an actor. Somebody hands you a gun. You should be able to pretend shoot at somebody with a gun that someone hands you on a movie set. And if that thing is tragically loaded and someone does tragically die, it seems like it's the fault of whoever loaded the gun, not the actor who fires it.
Which is the reason you hire those people and pay them so well and supposedly certify them and all the rest. Yeah, I tend to see it that way as well. Even though the gun owner in me knows you never handle a weapon of any kind unless you've checked it, inspected it, know exactly what's going on inside of it yourself. I'm willing to see that on a movie set, it might be different. Well, that's it for the debate. A double teeth itch episode here for Mark Davis and Rakeem Brooks. Gentlemen, thanks so much for the time. Thanks so much for the conversation. We'll see you all next time on The Debate.
Great to be with you.
I appreciate the time.